Now, Petrarch was by no means irreligious. The last bit of that quotation, I think, indicates that. But on another occasion, he said, theology is a poem that has God for its subject. So we mustn't suppose that in a figure like Petrarch, any more than in a figure like Boccaccio, we somehow are seeing that the Renaissance equals the Middle Ages minus religion. No, these are still deeply and, in many respects, conventionally religious people. Though Petrarch, for example, was bitterly critical of the Avignon papacy. What we can see in figures like Boccaccio and Petrarch is a dawning interest in classical literature, but not yet a clear and exclusive focus on it. We can see fame and fortune made in vernacular literature, in Italian, but also scholarly reputation made in Latin. In short, and as I was saying at the end of the previous lecture, we begin to get a feel for something new happening, but as yet it's hard to discern a movement. Now, in the generation after Petrarch, we begin to see the foundations for the period of Florentine greatness, and also the consolidation of certain intellectual traditions that I think we can say begin to look like a movement. You'll perhaps recall that I had said we can, broadly speaking, divide the Renaissance into three chronological periods, the period down to about 1370 or thereabouts, in other words, to the death, let's say, of Petrarch and Boccaccio, the individual period of individual genius, and then, in the second place, the Florentine period. So we come to that now. Let's begin this exploration of the Florentine moment with the Florentine chancellor, that is to say, one of the chief administrative officers of the city, Coluccio Salutati. Coluccio was born in 1331. He died in 1406. Now, he founded and endowed a considerable number of schools in Florence. Florence had no university then. There's one there now, but there was not there one there in the late Middle Ages. He himself was a prolific correspondent. He maintained connections with scholars all over Italy and beyond. Now, this kind of scholarly connectedness had also been true in the Middle Ages, but it is something that expands in the Renaissance period. So again, it's the scale of activity here that would strike us, not so much that all of a sudden there's an international community of scholars where previously there had been none. He attracted large numbers of significant cultural figures to Florence. Now, in the High Middle Ages, of course, where had those great figures been going? Mostly to Paris. Now, Coluccio was attracting interesting and important figures to Florence. And he secured them the means to lead lives of scholarly and artistic leisure. That is to say, he found them, in a sense, endowments so that they could get on with their work without having to worry about earning a living. A great patron, then, of learning. Coluccio himself wrote letters. He wrote orations. He wrote histories praising the past of his own city. Coluccio in particular took Cicero as his ideal. He argued that family life and public service. Now, do you remember how we saw that Cicero had written his book on the old age of Cato the Elder and had held up family life and public service as the great sturdy ideals of the Romans of old? So now Coluccio turns to Cicero, as indeed Cicero was himself turning to Cato, and says that it is public life, public service, and family life, not penance, not retreat from the world, not the cultivation of religious values that should be held up as exemplary. He argued that the liberty of free citizens, in other words, basically republican forms of government, created an environment in which people could flourish. We can see pretty clearly in Coluccio the two faces of what I called in the last lecture civic humanism. On the one hand, he was a great booster of Florence. On the other hand, he had this profound belief in the importance of republican government and participation in government by citizens. Now, with Guarino of Verona, who was born in 1374, died in 1460, we begin to discern a significant shift in educational theory. Now, he stressed Latin and Greek in all their classical purity as the keys to education. In distinction to the more practical uses of language, conveyed by the notarial arts that had thrived in the cities. Now, what does all that mean? Well, remember I mentioned in the previous lecture that one of the background factors to the emergence of the Renaissance in Italy was a generally higher level of lay literacy. But I also connected that literacy to the world of lawyers, to the world of businessmen, to the world of merchants, to the world of manufacturers.